Hello, and welcome to the sixth episode of Tech in Chicago. I'm Colin Keeley, and I interview Chicago's top founders and investors on this show. Today, I'm super excited to welcome Ezra Galston to the show. He's a VC at Chicago Ventures and our first investor on the show. At CV, Ezra focuses on consumer-facing investments. A few startups Ezra is actively involved in include Bloom Nation, Kapow Events, Luxury Garage Sale, Shift Gigs, Spot Heroes, Zipmints, and Havenly. He writes one of my favorite VC blogs at BreakingVC.com, and his thoughts on startups have also been published in the Wall Street Journal, TechCrunch, VentureBeat, and Recode. Before becoming a VC, Ezra is a professional poker player and the director of marketing for Card Runners Gaming, the parent company of Card Runners, Hold'em Manager, and Draft Day. In our wide-ranging interview, we talk about how he broke into VC, how he sources new deals, and why he loves investing in Chicago companies, just to name a few things. I really enjoyed this interview, and I think you will too. Here's Ezra. We have Ezra here today. Ezra, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Always exciting.
Let's start with your background. How'd you get into tech and VC?
Got horribly, horribly lost. I've been in tech for a long time, ever since I was pretty young. I used to, you know, back on AOL, in the 9600K modem days, was kind of, you know, in the wares community and like the AOL chat rooms, and did a lot with HTML1. I remember building out periodic table of the elements with table rows and TD cells and all that kind of stuff. So it's always been a passion of mine. When I graduated college, I actually played poker for a living for a couple of years and just kind of got burnt out on it. And I had a very close friend and actually here in Chicago, Taylor Cabey, who's starting a poker company called Card Runners, and joined him. And through that, we ended up having a few different technology companies under that kind of parent brand and started making some angel investments into tech companies as well. And it just kind of grew from there. So it's just kind of been in my blood since really I was, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old.
Then how'd you make the switch to get into venture capital?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I thought about it was, I'd been apart for several years of early stage tech startups. I went to business school because I looked at my resume, and my resume was like, you know, Card Runners, you know, tech startup no one's ever heard of. Hold'em Manager, tech startup no one's ever heard about. Professional poker player for 2 years. Okay, it's a little bit interesting. And it was like, if I wanted to do anything else in my life, I should put a big logo on my you know, CV. So I went to business school and just planned to go work at like Kroger, P&G, or someone stupid for 3 years just to put a big fat logo right on the resume. You know, I sat in a couple of those, you know, like job pitch meetings or whatever, and I just realized very quickly it wasn't for me. And I had a mentor at Booth, where I went to business school, at U of C, named John Tuff, who then was at Kleiner Perkins and now is the COO of a company called Choose Energy. He just said, listen, I think you've got a good acumen for VC. You know, there's a VC lab. You should try to apply. You've made some angel investments. You've got, you know, a lot of relatability. And it just kind of worked out from there. But really what I like to say is that, you know, I just honestly, and this is a lot of credit to entrepreneurs, I just didn't have the heart to go from zero to one again. I realized that what I'd seen at Card Runners and Hold'em Manager was going from kind of, you know, $500,000 to $5 million in sales really, really quickly. And that was something that I was passionate about and doing over and over again. But those first 12 months, I mean, you've done it before, those first 12 months of just getting everything set up from literally going from nothing to something, it's a very special time, but it's also a huge grind. And I just thought that I needed a few years of something different.
How'd you get into doing your own angel investments?
In order to make angel investments, unfortunately, you need a little bit of capital. So playing poker for a living for a few years had been very, very good to me. Baseball had been very, very good to me, right? And what ended up happening is, what happens in the poker world is a very emotionally volatile lifestyle. And so you've got a bunch of, and this was back in the day when money grew on trees in the poker world, but you have a lot of, you know, young, late teens, early 20-something kids who've made, you know, $500,000, $1 million, sometimes $5 million. But after a few years, like, the monotony starts to grow and it's very, very volatile, and they're swinging mid six figures, sometimes seven figures in a single day. And so they start to look to do something else. And so kind of all of my friends would sort of, you know, kind of parade around and everyone start to kind of circulate their business ideas. And I just funded, you know, a few of them. The first one was a friend of mine, Chris Fargis, who for a while had been one of the best high stakes players in the world. He started a company called Instant Fantasy Sports that at the time was, I believe, the first ever daily fantasy sports company. And we sold it to NBC back in 2009 or 2010. And so it was kind of some projects like that. But yeah, I mean, so in order to make angel investments, you need a little bit of disposable income. But you also need smart friends who are really ambitious and kind of thinking outside the box.
So you're at Chicago Ventures now. Can you talk a little bit about CV's history and what you guys like investing in?
Yeah. So CV was kind of founded with the belief that the Chicago venture scene was incredibly underserved when it came to seed capital and early stage capital. And that was back in, I guess, 2011 or so, 2012. The world has changed a little bit since then, right? You've got now a lot of funds in town, Hyde Park Venture Partners, Math Venture Partners. There's a couple other seed funds as well. I'd say that our mission, though, hasn't changed. I think that, you know, we've learned to be collaborative, but we're still focused on finding great entrepreneurs and ideas here in the Midwest. I'd say the only thing that's kind of changed is we've probably expanded our profile from Chicago, which is what it was in 2012, to the broader Midwest, which is kind of what it is now. You'll notice that we're pretty active down in Austin, you know, very active in Madison, among other places. We try to stay off the coast. Occasionally we make mistakes and you'll see us blip up. But that's typically where, you know, we have an existing relationship and an entrepreneur that we track closely in Chicago who happened to move, or, you know, in the case of, you know, I had friends from out of Chicago Booth who went through the New Venture Challenge at Booth, but they situated their company in Los Angeles. But we got to know them so well while they were in Chicago. So that's kind of where you see us kind of pop up outside. But the goal is to really fill in the underserved nature of early stage capital in Chicago and the broader Midwest, be pretty good guys about it, and gals. Try to be a very kind of neutral Switzerlandish body where we sort of look at ourselves as a conduit to, you know, the next stage of your business. So the truth is that there's not much where Chicago is still lacking. I mean, it's probably still lacking on the seed stage, but even further upstream towards the growth stage, it's really, really lacking. And so one of the things that we've tried to do is go out and build great relationships, not only with the growth people in Chicago and the Midwest, but also in New York City, in Boston, in San Francisco, so that we can kind of be the firm that everyone's calling on and saying, hey, what great things are happening in the Midwest? What can you show us? And we try to be that platform. So that's kind of how we think about ourselves and situate ourselves. We're moving a little bit upstream. Our average kind of check size now is probably, you know, $750,000 to $1 million, something like that. Whereas in our, you know, a little bit earlier, maybe a couple years ago, it was more in the $500,000 range, but still focused on, you know, early stage opportunities.
So you guys are based in 1871. How important is that proximity to your investments?
You can look at the map. I think it's about over half of our investments, and it might even be higher than that, are literally within like 10-minute walking distance of our office here. And I think that speaks really well to how much we focused on being, I guess, kind of, you know, good cheerleaders for Chicago, as well as finding great opportunities that are right here in River North, or at most kind of like the West Loop, right? Or maybe a little bit South Loop, whatever. I'd say that in general, you know, we've been in 1871 since before it opened, right? Since we moved in April of 2012, right? I don't think it formally opened until May or June of 2012, right? We were one of the first tenants, and it's been a pleasure to be here. I think some of the things that we noticed are that, it is the only kind of thing we ran into is that we tried to be really, really founder friendly, have an open door policy, right? And it just kind of made it hard to get work done. So we're sitting here now in, unfortunately, I guess, you know, listening at home, you can't see it, but we're sitting here now in our beautiful new office here on the 13th floor. 1871 kind of broke through the ceiling, built out in additional, I think, 25 or 30,000 square feet here on the 13th floor. And so we have an office up here. It's a little bit quieter, a little bit more reserved. The door is still open. You can still come knock, but I think we're not part of the tour like we used to be, right? So lots of good things. We're thrilled to be here.
So I always wondered this before. Your office was like almost dead center in 1871 and your door was always open. Did you ever have like crazies come in and pitch you all the time?
I think that's one where I'm just going to go with a no comment. Yeah. No, I mean, no one's crazy, so to speak. But I would say that, and listen, I think there is a, I certainly have respect for hustle. I think all of us here have probably shown up at an entrepreneur's office at one point kind of unannounced just because we couldn't get them to respond. I think we try to respond to everyone, so I don't think that was really the issue. But I'd say that there were probably more unannounced visits. Not than we cared for. It just, like I said, it just made it hard to make the day kind of cohesive. The door is always still open. But yeah, I'd say we're probably just a little bit more efficient, getting a little bit more work done now that, you know, we've got a little bit of space between us and the tour groups.
Now people have to walk up the stairs.
Yeah, it's just, it's you know, like we talk about friction a lot in early stage startups and what can you do to kind of, you know, optimize the funnel. You know, being upstairs just adds a level of friction in the funnel.
How do you measure success as a VC? I know you have a blog post on maybe changing that metric.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, success as a VC, I think, can only be measured at the end of the day in kind of financial returns. My job, whether entrepreneurs like to hear it or not, or frankly, whether I'm willing to admit it to myself or not, is to return capital to our limited partners, our investors, to make the rest of our team look good, right? In all those kinds of ways. So at the end of the day, the money is a financial job. It always feels weird to me when I, you know, have to click like financial services, you know, and like what's your profession? Because VC is so much about, you know, everything non-kind of, you know, financial related. We're not doing, you know, like, you know, discounted cash flows and terminal exit value. We're not doing stuff like that, especially here at the seed stage. And so it feels weird. But at the end of the day, you know, we are a financial, you know, a services firm, and that's kind of what we do. I think for me personally, outside of the returns, and the returns are just a difficult metric to measure yourself on, because you really don't know if you're any good for at a minimum, maybe 7 years, probably more likely like 10 to 15 years, which is kind of great because you can have a 15-year career and suck the whole way, right? And still get paid, right? But like in all seriousness, I think what the way that I've tried to focus my short-term thinking of what defines, you know, kind of a good early stage VC is to think about some things like, for instance, you know, if we seed a company, our model works, you know, maybe in a perfect world, we can give a company, you know, $1 million and that's all they ever need. In general, though, because we're going after big winner-take-all markets, big growth markets, there's going to be more capital that needs to come into the business. And so one of the things that I do look at is what percentage of the companies that, you know, I've invested in or been a part of, or even as a firm, right? It's important to look at as a firm, have raised follow-on capital, have reached the milestones that we've set out for them when we initially wrote our seed check. And so, you know, I'd say that that's one. We do look for other things. For instance, you know, it's kind of hard to measure, like, how close are you actually with an entrepreneur, right? You know, there are probably lots of entrepreneurs that I think I'm pretty close to that maybe don't. And so one of the things that we look at is, you know, when those follow-on fundraisings do come, how much are we prioritized? One of the kind of unspoken things that, well, I guess it's probably more known now, is that, you know, when companies are growing really fast and it's quote unquote a hot deal, right? And a bigger venture capital firm comes in, many of them don't care so much about the seed firms, right? And it's how many entrepreneurs are willing to go to bat for you, both as personal references, as well as to make room for you to enable you to keep investing in their company. And thankfully, here at Chicago Ventures, our track record on those metrics is very, very high. You can look at our website. We have all the companies up there. And, you know, I'd like to hope, I think, I hope that any entrepreneur you can call on there would say very, very good things about us and have a fair amount of respect for the way we've run our process and treated them. So that's really what you need to measure. That's really, I guess, how I'm looking at measurement in the short term is references, ability, founders kind of going to bat for the VC when that's necessary, as well as what those short-term VC successes stand for. And I should caveat that NASDAQ's been on fire for 8 years minus 2 months, right? Everything minus February and March, right? It's just been on fire. And so the metric of like follow-on fundraising, not very many companies have been dying until very, very recently. But even so, you know, what else are you going to look at, right? You have to look at something. But those metrics, it's kind of like, you know, like the curve in university is probably like, you know, everyone is probably performing a little bit above their kind of natural scale.
Where do you find these companies? Where are you sourcing your deals from?
So it's really a mix. I'd say that We do a fair amount of outbound here at CV. We'll kind of sit down, chat about some of our theses, areas that we're thinking. So easy ones here in Chicago would be, you know, healthcare opportunities, healthcare IT. You know, you've got a big $50 billion public company in Epic Systems in Madison that, you know, it turns out a lot of great thinkers. And so, you know, it's pretty, being in Chicago is a great place to start developing theses around healthcare IT, enterprise SaaS as well. You've got a third of the Fortune 500. So you can develop some really kind of aggressive theses and go out and try to find companies locally that are building that. So that's one source. I'd say what we really value are our referral networks. And, you know, that can be anything from an entrepreneur that we've invested in, an entrepreneur that we've passed on, but that we still maintain very close relationships with, our investors in our fund, as you know, down to, you know, some of the lawyers we work with, accountants we work with. You know, I'm not doing my job for the most part if I'm not, you know, trying to source new opportunities from just about anyone or anywhere. And there is the barriers to entry for starting a company are now so low. I mean, I don't know, maybe $10,000, $5,000 to get a website, like take a course to learn how to build something simple and, you know, a little bit of hosting, right? Like you can get off the ground for a lot less than $5,000, right? And so to actually start a company, the barriers are so low that it's happening everywhere. It's really our job is to try to find as many of those people as possible. So, you know, we do a mix of all that.
So you're seeing so many of these startups and funding less than 1% of them. How does an entrepreneur get you to say yes?
It's a tough question. It's a broad question. We do not right now have a formal checklist of like, you know, if you meet these six criteria, you get money. It's not that easy. Some other VC firms do have checklists that they'll basically run entrepreneurs and companies through basically once they've made it all the way to the funnel, right? And then you've got some firms like Social Capital that kind of have kind of top of the funnel entry point checklists and diligence marks where they'll basically just put you into a pool compared to, you know, relative to your peers, see how you perform, and the top X percent will kind of make it down the funnel a little bit. And that's only one way they do deals, but they've kind of published some blogs on that, and it's pretty interesting. There's no hard and fast rule. It sounds so cliche to say, but we look for really exceptional people. And that comes in different, you know, different forms. An exceptional person might be someone who's founded a billion-dollar public company. That's certainly exceptional. An exceptional person might be someone who, has faced a lot of adversity in their life and pulled through it. An exceptional person might be someone who, you know, came to America as an immigrant with nothing and worked their way up. There's different ways of defining exceptional, but we're always looking for kind of outliers when it comes to people. And I'd say that, you know, you can be an outlier in different ways. You can be an outlier because your passion and authenticity is just so off the charts that you're in kind of like the top 1% of authentic kind of entrepreneurs we've ever met. It's hard to define. I'd say that's kind of the first thing we look for, but there are many, many variables and probably too complicated for a quick conversation.
Venture capital is often called an apprenticeship business where you really have to learn from the people that have done it before. How do you go about finding and cultivating these mentors?
Yeah, it's really hard. It's really, really hard. And there's no one way. I think that, and that's a great question. I think that that is the question for anyone entering the business or interested in entering the business. It's tough. I feel really, really blessed that 4 years in, I now have a couple of mentors, but, you know, probably less than half a dozen, maybe half a dozen of people that when I get into a bind, I feel completely comfortable opening up and saying, hey, I'm screwing up or I'm really confused, just non-judgmental. How do I walk through this? And the key is finding people who aren't, I don't know what the right word is, who aren't fakers, but who've really been there, and, you know, aren't just kind of like, I like to be active on Twitter, but aren't just tweeting about stuff, but have really been self-aware, about the processes, the mistakes they've made, what they've learned over the course of their career. And so that is the challenge. So how did I go about it? I mean, I'll walk you kind of through it. I'd say that one of my mentors, so when I was first getting into VC, And when I basically took an internship through Chicago Booth, and I said, well, you know, this is kind of interesting. I'm really having a good time. I should see what else is out there. So I, you know, fired off 70 cold emails to VCs in San Francisco and New York. And I treated it just like you would any sales funnel, right? It was like, okay, so what do I get a response on? If I didn't get a response, then, you know, I'm going to look back at the firm and find the next partner that I'm most closely aligned to, change my messaging a little bit, go back to that partner. If I did get a response, how many of those convert into a phone call? If it converted into a phone call, how many of those convert into, you know, an invitation to come out to San Francisco and meet with them or one of their partners or whatever it is, right? I'd say of the 70, I probably flew out to San Francisco and met with 6 of them. And probably 3 or 4 of them I'm still in regular touch with. One of them I actually just emailed this week. So, you know, some of those people, one of them I would say is a mentor for me. He's a kind of a younger partner in the VC industry. But as I was kind of trying to figure out what's my role and how do you work your way up, having someone who's actually not a 30-year GP can actually be a really great asset. Someone who's kind of, you know, just 2 years ahead of you in terms of their own career growth. And then, you know, others is once you're in, it's actually a little bit easier to connect with other VCs because you can say, hey, we're in, you know, these deals, you know, we should probably, maybe there's something to chat about, or you might want to take a look at it, right? And you come across people, you just have an element of credibility kind of changes a little bit. But, you know, one of the mentors that I'm growing closest to right now, I saw something this person had written or given in an interview, and I said, this seems really odd to me. I don't understand it. And I sent them a cold email, and I said, can you just kind of like, here's how I understand like the world. Here's how you presented it. It seems completely counterintuitive to me. Like, what's going on? And the person wrote back and said, you know, here's the answer. And then I said, you know, and then I said, oh, well, can we chat about it in person or something like that? And the response was, you know, I never do this, but, you know, why not? Right. And just kind of that's kind of over the last year and a half progressed into a really nice relationship. And so, you know, these things come from all places. I think what it is if you ask someone, hey, will you be my mentor? Right. Like the rule of VC, the ultimate VC paradox, and why it's also so hard to get jobs in VC, is that VCs have no time. We're constrained by time. Time is the greatest asset. And the reason that it's counterintuitive is that the answer should be, well, go hire more people and that will help you with your time. The problem is that in order to hire someone and train someone takes up even more of your time, right? And so that's the ultimate paradox. And that's why it's just like so complicated to get involved. But that's how I think about things. And so you can't just say, will you be my mentor? Because no one has the time. It's got to be, you just develop a relationship. You got to play the long game. Some of these relationships I've been working on for 4 years and it's not transactional. I deeply like the people I'm communicating with, but it takes time until someone is comfortable enough with you and you've opened up enough to them that they can really open up to you.
So who are some of these investors you look up to and maybe try to emulate?
Oh, people I try to emulate. I mean, first off, I definitely try to emulate some of the people I'm, you know, who I'm close to. I'd say that, you know, I don't know, like Bill Gurley, Fred Wilson, like, you know, Mark Suster, like these guys are not, you know, writing me notes or on a regular basis or kind of ever. Those are certainly people I look up to, each of them for different reasons. I think, you know, Brad Feld, Mark Suster, Fred Wilson. I love blogging. I like to say that it's cathartic or catharsis, whatever. My English has gone downhill. I married an English major, and it just I don't know. I just haven't kept up. I love writing. I love blogging. I've probably been slower than I'd like recently, just because some of my other duties here at CV have just been getting taxed more and more, and I have a 6-month-old, you know, second child. So just, you know, I just don't sleep as much. And right. And so time is tough. But I look up to them, and I actually wrote a post called How the Hell Do You Do It or something like that. Because they are just masters of managing time. They're writing on almost a daily basis. Some of them on a daily basis, they are chairing boards of some of the, you know, most interesting companies in the world. They seem to always have time for entrepreneurs. They seem to always have time for press. They are often the kind of like managing GP interfacing with their investors. Like, I just don't know how they do it. They seem to have happy family lives, or at least that's what they put on their blog, right? So like, how the hell do you do it? I look up to that, and I haven't figured out that balance. I hope to. I look up to someone like Bill Gurley. I think that, you know, Bill Gurley, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is kind of emotional volatility in this business. I look around and I see a lot of investors who can, you know, in poker, we have a term called going on tilt. I don't know if you played poker, but it's like you lose a pot and like the next pot, you're just like, ah, crap, I don't even care, right? There's a lot of emotional volatility in this business where one day you're kind of on top of the world. The next day seems like everything's, you know, going wrong, right? It's just the way it is. Bill Gurley is someone who just seems to have mastered emotional volatility. He's just so balanced. And just kind of sees through kind of all the noise in the world. And if it takes 6 years for, you know, what he sees in the math to, you know, pan out, then so be it. I was watching The Big Short recently with my wife, and I was just thinking to myself, like, yeah, like, you know, people saw something in the numbers that was statistically factual and just, you know, went with it. It wasn't an intuition bet. It was statistically factual. Gurley is one of the few who, you know, when everyone else is just kind of following hype, he's always grounded. That's really hard to do, especially as a young person in this business, to not get caught up in the hype. I personally struggle with that a lot.
So Mark and like Chris Sacca have these new Snapchats where they dish out advice. We're going to be seeing a Breaking VC Snapchat soon here.
I would love to. I'll admit I kind of suck at Snapchat. It's not my strongest platform. I need to work on it. I do. You know, it was interesting. I actually, I remember maybe a year and a half ago, I asked David Hornick. I said, blogging is commoditized. I blog, but I blog for myself. I'm not, it happens to be that sometimes it creates press and whatever, and that's great, but really I'm doing it for myself. But I said, blogging is commoditized. Where is brand building in the venture world going to happen next? And he said, no one's really cracked video. And so, you know, Snapchat, video, however you want to look at it. I think there's opportunities on YouTube as well, to be honest, of kind of some short form video opportunities. It's all stuff I'd love to do. It's just, you know, it's a busy time. I'll get there. So
how important is that, producing content as a venture capitalist? Is that where you get much deal flow out of it?
So I've actually been surprised by how much deal flow I've got out of it. I just kind of thought to myself, you know, young guy in Chicago, who's going to pay attention to me? And it turns out that I guess people are kind of starved for content, or it turns out that entrepreneurs who see a kindred spirit in someone who's deeply passionate about a space that they're working on just want to connect and talk about it. You know, I guess I've realized that as well, being kind of here in the venture world, is that, you know, there aren't a ton of people who are in my exact position or thinking about working their way up in the venture world in the same way that I am. And when you spot someone who is, like, I write a lot of cold emails to people when I spot someone who I say to myself, that person's thinking about the same things or going through the same issues. And so I get it. So for instance, like I wrote a post about kind of like the future of furniture in a millennial world. And I probably had over 20, maybe 30 at this point, kind of inbound from entrepreneurs who were working on kind of, you know, next gen furniture companies or something in the kind of furniture world that wanted to chat. I probably took 8 of those meetings and we actually almost invested in one. It didn't work out, but I went down some pretty deep diligence on it. And so, you know, it does work. But again, I do it for myself. I care about branding, but at the end of the day, the blogging is for me, no one else. And I've actually been, I mean, I have a bunch of posts I just haven't posted that I probably should, that are just kind of, I don't know, they're a little bit intimate, but I may just publish them. And I'd been holding back because the readership has grown. But I guess I just, you know, at some point I probably shouldn't care and I should just kind of stay true to myself, but I'm still figuring that out.
I look forward to seeing it. I like how honest you are in all your posts.
Appreciate
that. Very transparent.
Appreciate that.
What areas of tech do you think are underestimated?
I mean, I wouldn't say this is like revolutionary by any means, but if you talk to most smart investors, they're pretty bearish as a whole on kind of e-commerce as a segment. And I look at the numbers and, you know, this is just looking at statistical numbers, and maybe, you know, again, everything is up to interpretation. That's the problem with numbers and data. But I look at the data and I look at how much of the world is still transacting in an offline manner. And there will always be some percentage, but it's probably not going to be 85%, probably not going to be 90%, right? And I look at you know, millennial tendencies and current consumer processes, as well as in developing countries and the emerging world. And it's, you know, it's hard for me to be bearish on a category that is probably going to grow another, you know, five times over the coming few years or the coming decade, two decade, whatever it is, as more and more purchasing moves online, becomes predictive, becomes subscription-based, whatever it is connected to smart devices and smart meters. And a lot of it is just going to become brainless. And so maybe, you know, your average, like, you know, just SKU-based e-commerce site, maybe that isn't what breaks out. But again, if you talk to good investors, there are many of them, even the ones that are bullish on consumer, you know, technology and potential, are pretty bearish on commerce as a category, kind of pure play commerce. And I just look at the data, and I don't know exactly how it's going to come out, whether it's just going to be, you know, traditional, you know, Amazon-ish kind of stuff, probably not, whether it's going to be some of the intermediate concierge models that we're seeing right now, which is, you know, like a Trunk Club or a Stitch Fix or a Havenly or something like that, or, you know, what it'll look like in the future. Whether it'll be something predictive, I don't even think anymore, it taps into my brain. Like, I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but I know that there will continue to be a lot of innovation there just because the market dynamics and shifts are so strong. So that would say, as I guess, an underestimated category where you look at a lot of the public companies like Wayfair and Zulily was taking it out, and they're trading at pretty low multiples. I mean, these things are cyclical. 2 years ago, again, everyone was bearish on e-commerce. Zulily came public, raced to a $10 billion market cap. Everyone flooded back into investing in e-commerce companies because it was, you know, it was 4x revenue or something like that. And everyone was like, oh my gosh, you know, e-commerce is great again. And then the market contracted, everyone pulled out of e-commerce, right? And there's just these cycles. And so I try to stay focused on the data and make decisions based on that. But yeah, I don't know. I'd have to think about other underestimated areas. That's tough. I tend to think some of the ones that are underestimated are probably true. I saw a great tweet on the Converse. I saw a great tweet from Mike Maples maybe a couple weeks ago that said, you know, ad tech has been so, you know, kind of so crapped on that it's probably likely a great opportunity for investing. I think that tends to be true. Just, you know, at the point where most investors want to leave a category probably means you're starting to see some opportunities there again. Again, it's easy to say you should be counterintuitive, right? Startup L. Jackson, kind of the counterintuitive thing about counterintuitive things or whatever it is, right? And I get that. It's now like trendy to be counterintuitive, but it's a lot harder to make anti-cyclical, you know, counterintuitive bets when the entire world is moving against you. It's just the way it is. You know, I like to trade stocks and stuff, and like when everyone is bleeding red, it's so hard to get in there and just, you know, click the buy button, but it's often the best time. And that also goes back to that kind of emotional balance that I was talking about earlier. I think about this stuff a lot, but yeah, still working on it.
What's your most recent investment and why did you say yes?
Yeah. So our most recent investment, I actually just checked on this. We actually haven't announced a new investment since November. We've made a number. I guess I should kind of just make a quick parenthesis here, parenthetical. You know, it's not up to us. Like when we announce an investment, it's up to the entrepreneurs and depends on a lot of strategic things for them. And we have no control over that, nor would we want to influence that in any way. But just in terms of the ones that are public and announced, we announced our investment in a company called Havenly in November. And actually they just announced a further financing actually this morning. And that is basically a concierge commerce platform kind of connecting interior designers directly with homeowners, apartment renters, whatever it might be, who want kind of some, you know, lightweight, low cost design help. And that came out of a pain point. You know, you asked about how you source deals. That one was a thesis of mine. And I went out and I spoke to, I believe, almost every company there. At one point, there were maybe a dozen companies going after this. There's now maybe three or four. And I spoke to probably almost everyone in the space because I bought a house. This is the fun part of VC. You get to be a consumer, right? And then just go solve problems. Bought a house. My wife and I had a bunch of rooms. We hired an interior designer. You know, she was nice enough, but it was $200 an hour. The minimum spend, I think, was 10 hours. After 10 hours, we had very little, right? We didn't have any furniture. We had very little. And again, we were indecisive, but even so, and I think that, you know, you find this a lot with kind of younger buyers, like, A, I don't want to have to be around in my house for 10 hours to like meet with a designer or go back and forth, right? I just want it kind of quickly, a little bit quickly on demand. I want to get you a picture of my room, get some mock-ups. And I just need some guidance and help, like, you know, confirmation bias, external validation, whatever you want to think about. And so that was kind of the thesis with Havenly. So instead of, you know, spending $2,000, $5,000, $10,000 on a room, you're spending, you know, $179 on a room. If you just need a little bit of help finding some accessories, you're spending $79 plus the cost of furniture, obviously. But it was a pain point that I'd lived and experienced and made so much sense to me. I would say the other part of the investment, why we made it, is that the problem with an investment or a company like Havenly is that investments, companies where you spend a lot of money to acquire a customer and then you only get to engage with them once over the lifetime of your company, those are tough businesses to build. You can get away with it if you're Zillow and you're selling a house, right, which is a big purchase. You can get away with it if you're, you know, eBay Auto or eBay Motors or CarMax, right, where you're selling a car. Right. But when it comes to selling furniture, right, we might be selling you $500 of furniture. We might be selling you $5,000 of furniture. But even so, it's not a car and it's not a house. Right. So if you're only going to see a customer once every 10 years when they, you know, buy a house, an apartment or move, that's a pretty tall order. And so, you know, the first time I ever chatted with Lee Mayer, who's the CEO of Havenly, you know, she said, my focus is, of course, I want to, you know, deliver a great experience in that first engagement. But she said, my focus is on building a long-term sustainable relationship with the customer where anytime they have any question about design, their house, they want to, you know, change their throw pillows, that they just have this personal concierge they can get on, you know, or they can get on the web, they can text, whatever it is. It's like a stylist in your pocket for your home. You kind of have that at Trunk Club, but you don't have that for your home. And she was focused on the long-term customer, not this, you know, not just a quick flip, right? And as a consumer myself, that sounded like heaven to me. And so, you know, when Lee met the whole team here, and Emily and Jesse and Gabe, they're very, very special people. It was our first investment in Denver. We don't often go that far west, but it was easy to do once you met them.
So you've been at this for a few years now.
Four
years. Is there anything you wish you knew when you got started?
Yeah. I mean, I just wish I knew how... I wish I knew how hard of an industry it was. I meet with a lot of, you know, students out of Booth and Kellogg, two of the grad schools here in town, who are interested in VC. And, you know, it in spite of, I think, all the transparency on blogs and forums, a lot of that is coming from kind of senior general partners, right? Fred Wilson, Brad Feld, Mark Suster. They can speak to the fact that it's a cutthroat industry, which it is. It's cutthroat, but a lot of industries are cutthroat. I mean, if you want to go work in banking, that's also a tough job, right? Or if you want to be an entrepreneur, that's also a tough job. My goal isn't to say that any of those jobs are, my job is harder than theirs. Being an entrepreneur is certainly harder. But I think that there are unique hardships to kind of working your way up and starting out in the VC industry, just because of how opaque the industry is. And I'm blessed that, you know, I'm at a great firm and I lean on Stuart Larkins here a lot. He's been an exceptional mentor to me and I think is, you know, one of the great investors that I've met in my 4 years in VC. And it's very special to have someone like that in Chicago. But, you know, even so, it's a tough industry for young people. And, you know, I think that all the kind of feedback I got when I was interested in VC was, you know, how to show that you were dedicated to the industry, how to hit the ground running on day one. If you could find an opportunity with a firm or an internship or whatever it is. And I don't think there were many people who kind of, you know, said, you know, kind of step back. Like, what are you actually trying to accomplish? What are you actually looking to do? Because I was probably 2 years into my venture career when I sort of stepped back and thought to myself, like, you know, what am I really doing here? Am I a reactive person or am I a proactive person? Do I want to be, you know, an analyst in the venture world or, you know, do I want to be, you know, a senior guy, right? And the way you're going to treat your jobs, the way you're going to treat your job is very much dependent on how you've conceptualized what the venture business is to you. And, you know, it's a tough industry. A lot of industries are tough industries, but it's cutthroat. You know, people are getting smarter. More and more young people come in. They've got time, hustle, and here I am, an old man of 30, you know, with two kids and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But it's I guess the question was, what do I wish I'd known? I think I would have also wished I'd known just how fulfilling it is. It's certainly having kids and getting married, I think, are the two kind of highlights of my life. But I think that, you know, having an entrepreneur who effectively calls you, you know, crying one day and is on top of the world another after they've kind of beaten a hurdle, that's an exceptional feeling. And you know, you play a really small part in it, but just to be involved in that and have the opportunity is very special. So I'd say the highs and lows, here's how I'll sum it up. The highs and lows are more extreme than what I had perceived before I entered the industry. But overall, it's a big blessing to be here.
So we'll get into some Chicago specific questions now. What do you think Chicago does well as a tech scene?
As a tech scene, I think we do a lot of things well. I think overall there is a lot of collaboration. There is a lot of support. There are a lot of events. I haven't dug into the numbers around kind of our lead in terms of female founders, but I think in terms of promoting diversity and looking at, you know, and being kind of blinders on, just focusing on building great businesses, I think we do that very well. I think Chicago, from a business perspective, is very good at building healthy businesses. You know, we're 6 weeks, 8 weeks past kind of the great market tech recession, you know, of 2016 when LinkedIn dropped 50% in a day and so did all the enterprise companies. And, you know, tons of VCs were looking at their books and saying, are these companies overvalued? Are we gonna have to make changes? And, you know, listen, obviously you can refine any business, but we looked at the businesses that we've invested in the Midwest and they were just smart, thoughtful. They didn't overspend. They weren't based on hype. There was just a lot of good stuff. And I think there's just a lot of sound business fundamentals going into it. I think that, you know, for a while that was probably, you know, perceived as a weakness maybe. They, you know, some people would say, oh, well, they're not growing fast enough. And having been through that, and I'm still learning in this business, but having been through that, I'm so glad that I'm here in the Midwest and building great, healthy businesses.
And then what do you think we could improve on?
Things that we could improve on. You know, one of the things that I've made a mission for myself, and I still fail at it, but at least I'm working on it. And again, I'm in the venture world at this point. Like, I try to be as close as I can to like the entrepreneurial world, but, at the end of the day, I probably spend, you know, I don't know, a larger percentage of my time with, you know, other venture capital people than, say, would, you know, a random individual on the street, but certainly like an entrepreneur in general, right? And so one of the things that I thought about is that when I first got started in Chicago, no one reached out to me. No one said, hey, Ezra, saw you got a job with Chicago Ventures, would, you know, love to take you out, would love to, you know, get to know you, introduce ourselves. I'm at firm such and such. And so what I've tried to do is that whenever I hear that kind of someone's been hired at a local firm, I try to, you know, reach out to them and just say, you know, listen, like anything I can do to be helpful, take them out for coffee, whatever it is. I probably haven't done a great job of it. I've done it at least half a dozen to a dozen times, so it's better than zero. I would say that in general though, I'm trying to think about the best way to express that. I think that that probably also applies for kind of the entrepreneurial world as well. And what I mean by that is that I think that in San Francisco, there's a bit more openness to the fact that any random kid on the street could be the next Mark Zuckerberg because it's happened now dozens of times, right? Whereas in Chicago, I think that if, you know, random kid number one, you know, comes to you with a big idea, there's just a tendency amongst most people to just discount it because you're not part of the old guard, you know, you don't have X experience or whatever it is. And so one of the things that I think Chicago could improve on, myself included, is paying a bit more respect to that. And that doesn't mean, again, there's not enough time in the day for myself or anyone else at CV to take a meeting with every single person who reaches out to us. But there are special people that probably don't you know, match up on paper with the traditional mold. And if you've been in the Valley, for, you know, 20 years and seen these people who don't make sense on paper become your outliers, you're more attuned to looking for it. And that's something that I think Chicago as a whole needs to, both from, you know, a venture perspective or even like a biz dev perspective. So I'd say that, what we're doing well on in that front is that 1871 has been a great equalizer, actually, because it provides a pretty democratic platform for lots of big companies that are coming in. Anytime, you know, an innovation team comes through, 1871 will try to put, you know, four or six companies in front of them. So there are increasingly more opportunities. I guess this is more just an indictment of myself that I need to be a little bit more self-aware when I see some of those variables coming together.
Now, one question that I like to ask everyone, do you have any favorite books? It could be tech or otherwise.
My favorite book ever probably is The Little Prince. I was, for better or worse, certainly influenced by Ayn Rand. I don't know if I'm a, I mean, whatever. I just thought they were interesting books. But I don't know, these days I'm mostly reading kids' books, children's books, because I have a 3.5-year-old and a 6-month-old. So I don't know, I'm reading a lot of Sweet Pickles, which was a big book series like in the 70s and 80s that we somehow got a series of.
We'll be sure to toss it in the show notes.
Yeah, please do. Other really, really good stuff that I've read recently. So right now I'm reading a book called, or I recently finished a book called Seeing What Others Don't. Just try to, you know, how do you, just thoughts on how you can make better decisions and how you can become more self-aware about your own thought processes. There's just so much bias in this business that if you are not constantly attacking your own biases, you're just going to make the same mistakes over and over.
Have you seen the movie Little Prince?
No, I actually haven't.
No, it's coming to Netflix soon.
Okay, cool. I'll definitely check it out. Yeah, I mean, that's a big problem is Netflix is also, I mean, there's so many great shows on Netflix that like my wife and I actually don't own a TV. I mean, I guess we're considered cord cutters. But even so, like there's so much great content on Netflix that I probably waste too much time.
So we're reaching the end of the show here. What of your portfolio companies are you fired up about and where can they find them?
All of them at chicagoventures.com. In all seriousness, I don't think it's a great idea to start to kind of, I don't know, prioritize any one over the other. You can find the companies that I work most closely with, both on kind of like my profile page on chicagoventures.com or LinkedIn or whatever. And those are the ones that I'm personally most excited about because they're the ones that I spend the most time with. But honestly, I think that, you know, as a firm, we've invested in some really extraordinary companies. I couldn't be more excited having seen the companies we invested in over the last 18 months. It's just crazy to me how talented and accomplished the people that we're investing in are. And for the ones that are maybe for the entrepreneurs that are maybe younger and aren't quote unquote as accomplished, like the stories and the ambition and the authenticity are also just off the charts. And so, you know, one of the things about a firm getting 4 years in is that the amount of opportunities you're seeing has just kind of grown. And it's you just keep finding extraordinary people. I'm constantly blown away that people so special are out there. Like we invest in someone and I'll say like, I just don't believe that there's someone else like this person out there. Right. And then you find someone else with similar characteristics and you're just like, wow. So it's fun. It's special.
And then where can people find you online?
I'm certainly active on Twitter at Ezramoji, however you want to think about it. How else can they find me? We have an open door here at 1871, but please be at least reasonably respectful. And then I don't know, you can come to my house. Like I'm probably not that hard to find. I prefer not though. And then other places, I don't know, Ezra@chicagoventures.com. I try to be pretty good on email. Things fall through the crack. Sorry about that, but always follow up.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited for the new podcast and to see it grow.
Huge thank you to Ezra for coming on the show. Definitely check out his blog at breakingvc.com and subscribe so you get his new articles delivered to your inbox. Please also subscribe and review Tech in Chicago and iTunes. We only have 8 reviews so far, so every review helps a lot. If you guys have any feedback or guests you'd like to hear from on the show, I'm always happy to chat. I've gotten some great recommendations for guests recently, and I would love to have some more. Please reach out at Tech in Chicago on Twitter. See you next week.